remember. When she heard a page with a name she recognized, she'd pick up a house phone and the operator would put my call through. If the feds wanted someone badly enough, I knew they could find a way to wiretap the payphones that a close relative or associate regularly used. So why take the chance? A casino hotel routinely handled dozens of phone calls at a time, maybe hundreds. Even if McGuire and company were determined enough to keep an eye on my mother in hopes I would call her and reveal my location, they could not easily track a call passing through the busy switchboard of a place like Caesar's Palace. Since I'd never been a fugitive before, except for the few months in Oroville as a juvenile, I had no way of knowing how I'd react. Stepping so far off the grid was scary, but I could already tell I was going to enjoy it. It felt like the start of an exciting adventure. 26. Private Investigator. It would be the first time I'd ever been completely on my own. Going to live in Denver without my mom and Graham seemed strange, but also exhilarating. When my plane took off from Vegas, I would literally disappear into the ether. Once in my new hometown, I'd start hiding in plain sight. Can you imagine the freedom of starting your life over again, taking on a new name and identity? Of course, you'd miss your family and friends, the comfort of familiar places, but if you could put that part aside for a moment, wouldn't it feel like a great adventure? During the flight to the Mile High City, I felt a growing sense of anticipation. When the United Airlines plane landed, it was a bit anticlimactic. Denver was overcast and gloomy that afternoon. I got into a cab and asked the driver to take me to a hotel in a good neighborhood where I could rent a room by the week. The place he picked out was in what he referred to as Hotel Row. I would rate the hotel at about 2.5 stars or something on the order of a Motel 6. It turned out not to offer a weekly rate after all, but with a little persuasion I managed to negotiate one I could live with. Because of the way the movies portray it, people assume that living as a fugitive means always looking over your shoulder in constant fear of discovery. In the years that followed, I would have that experience, only rarely. For the most part, once I'd established my new identity and solidified it with a verifiable, government-issued ID, I felt secure. Just to be on the safe side, I always set up early warning systems so I'd be tipped off if someone came looking for me. And if I noticed anyone getting close, I would take immediate action. But from the very start, I would be enjoying myself the vast majority of the time. My first order of business in any new city was to compromise the local phone company so I could prevent anyone from easily tracking me. For starters, I'd need one of the dial-up phone numbers that field techs used to call into the phone company switch. I would get the number for the central office that handled the telephone exchanges I wanted to gain control of. I'd call and say something like, "Hi, this is Jimmy over in engineering. How you doing today?" Then I'd follow up with, "What's the dial-up for the VDU?" using the shorthand term for the visual display unit, which gives a tech full access to the switch from a remote location. The neat part was that if the switch was a 1AESS, you didn't even need a password to access it. Whoever made that decision must have figured that anyone who knew the phone number was authorized. Usually the guy I got on the line would give me the phone number for dialing into the switch of his central office. But if a tech challenged me, I knew enough about the system to make up a plausible excuse on the fly. It might be something like, "We're setting up a new dial-out system here and programming all the dial-up numbers into our outgoing dialer software, so if any switch engineers have to dial in, they can just instruct the modem to dial a particular office." Once I had the phone number for dialing into the switch, I could do pretty much anything I liked. If I wanted to have a series of conversations with someone in, say, Japan, I'd find an unassigned phone number, take it over, add call forwarding, and then activate it to forward any incoming calls anywhere I wanted. Then from my cell phone, I could make a local call to the previously unassigned phone number and have a clear, direct connection from the switch straight to the guy in Japan, instead of having to deal with an unreliable international cell phone connection. And I would also routinely use the technique called masking, setting up a chain of call forwarding numbers in switches of several cities in different parts of the country. Then calling the first number in the chain, my call would be passed along the chain from city to city, ultimately to the number I wanted, making it extremely time-consuming for anyone to trace the calls back to me. My calls weren't just free, they were virtually untraceable. My first morning in Denver, I sat down with a local newspaper and began circling job ads for computer work. I was looking for any company that used my favorite operating system, VMS. I created a separate resume for each likely-sounding ad, tailored to the particular qualifications listed. As a rule, I'd read the qualifications they were looking for and tailor a resume that showed I had around 90% of the skills on the company's wish list. If I claimed every sought-after skill, I figured the HR people or the head of IT might wonder, if he's that good, why is he applying for such a low-level job? My resume would list only a single previous job, so I wouldn't have to create more than one past job reference. The trick here was to keep copies of all the material I sent out so I'd know what I had written when someone called me for an interview. Along with the resume, I'd include a well-polished cover letter to introduce myself. My skill at writing these phony resumes and letters paid off within a couple of weeks. I was invited for an interview at, of all places, the local office of a prominent international law firm, Holm, Roberts & Owen, which had offices in Denver, Salt Lake City, Boulder, London, and Moscow. Dressed in a suit and tie and looking, I thought, perfectly suitable for a job in an upscale law firm, I was shown into a conference room to meet with the IT manager, a very friendly lady named Lori Sherry. I'm good at interviews, but this one was a little more exciting than most as I struggled not to be distracted. Lori was really attractive, but, bummer, she was wearing a wedding band. She started off with what must be a standard opening. Tell me a little about yourself. I tried for charming and charismatic, the style that the remake of Ocean's 11 would capture a few years later. I broke up with my girlfriend and wanted to get away. The company I was working for offered me more money to stay, but I knew it would be better to start fresh in a different city. Why Denver? Oh, I've always loved the Rocky Mountains. So, a plausible reason for leaving my last job. Check that one off the list. For half an hour, we went through all the standard things about my short and long-term goals and other typical interview topics. She took me on a tour of the computer room, and then I was given a 4- or 5-page written test on my system administrator skills, mostly on the Unix and VMS operating systems. I gave a couple of wrong answers, again, so I wouldn't look overqualified. I thought the interview had gone well. For job references, I had set up a phony company in Las Vegas, Green Valley Systems, and then rented a mailbox and signed up with an answering service that used live operators, who had instructions to tell callers, "No one is available to take your call right now," and then ask them to leave a message. After the interview, I started calling the service every hour. The next day, there was a message for me. Lori wanted to speak with Green Valley's IT director. Excellent. I had already scouted a hotel with a large lobby that offered acoustics like an office area, and checked that there was a payphone out of the stream of traffic. I couldn't chance calling her on my cloned cell phone because the call would show up on the real cell customer's bill. Lowering my voice an octave or so and adopting a bit of a pompous tone, I provided Eric Weiss with a very favorable recommendation. I got a job offer a few days later at a salary of $28,000. Nothing to brag about, but enough to meet my needs. I was supposed to start work 2 weeks later. Great. That would give me time to find an apartment, fill it with a load of rental furniture, and then dive into an important project that had been on my mind. My Eric Weiss identity was safe and verifiable. Still, there was already a real Eric Weiss walking around in Portland with the same social security number, birth date, and alma mater. That was okay for the time being, since the other Eric lived far enough away that our paths weren't likely to cross, but I wanted an identity I could safely use for the rest of my life. 19 states, including California and South Dakota, at the time had open death records, meaning the documents were a matter of public record, available to anyone. Those states hadn't yet caught on to how easy they were making things for someone like me. There were other states that would have been more convenient for me to get to, but South Dakota seemed so remote that I figured there was much less chance some other guy in my situation might search its records and come up with one or more of the identities I had found. Before setting out, a bit of preparation. My first stop was King Super's supermarket, where there was a machine on which you could enter your own text and instantly print out 20 business cards for $5. My new cards read, Eric Weiss, private investigator. Below those lines were a fake Nevada PI license number, a phony Vegas address, and an office number that went to another live answering service, in case someone decided to check up on me. The monthly $30 fee was a cheap way to create believability, which I was going to need. With the cards in my wallet, I threw a couple of suits and some other clothes and my toilet kit into a bag, boarded a plane for Sioux Falls, and once there, rented a car to drive to the capital city of Pierre. The four-hour drive was mostly on autopilot due west into the late afternoon sun along flat Interstate 90, with small towns I'd never heard of scattered along the way. Much too rural for this city boy. I was glad I was just passing through. Here comes the ballsy part. The next morning, dressed in the suit I had worn for my law firm interview, I found my way to the offices of the State Registrar for Vital Statistics, where I asked to speak with someone in charge. Within minutes, the registrar herself walked up to the counter, something I couldn't quite picture happening in a state like New York or Texas or Florida, where the top official would no doubt be too busy or feel too self-important to meet with anyone lacking important connections. I introduced myself and handed her my business card, explaining that I was a private investigator from Las Vegas working on a case. My mind flashed back to one of my favorite television shows, The Rockford Files. I smiled as she looked at my card because the quality was about the same as the ones Rockford created using that business card printer he kept in his car. In fact, the registrar wasn't just willing to see me, she was happy to assist a private investigator in carrying out his research task, which I told her was a confidential investigation into deaths. "Which person?" she asked, wanting to be helpful. "We'll look it up for you." Not at all what I wanted. "We're looking for people who died from certain causes of death," I ventured, "so I need to look through all the records for the years of interest." Though I was afraid the request sounded a bit strange, South Dakota was a be-friendly-to-your-neighbor kind of place. She didn't have any reason to be suspicious, and I was ready to accept all the help she was willing to give. The very friendly registrar asked me to come around the counter, and I followed her to a separate, windowless room that held the old certificates on microfiche. I emphasized that I had a significant amount of research to do and that it might take me several days. She just smiled and said I might be interrupted if a staff member needed to use the fiche, but otherwise it shouldn't be a problem. She had one of her assistants show me how to use the microfiche and where to find the films for particular ranges of years. I would be working in the microfiche room, unsupervised, with access to all the birth and death records going as far back as the state had been keeping them. I was looking for infants who had passed away between 1965 and 1975, at an age between 1 and 3. Why would I want a birth year that would make me so much younger than my actual age? Because I could pass for that much younger, and if the feds ever used age criteria when searching recently issued driver's licenses in a state where they thought I might be living, they would, I hoped, skip right over me. I was also looking for a white baby boy with an easily pronounced Anglo-sounding surname. Trying to pass for Indian, Latino, or black would obviously not work, unless I intended to have a good makeup artist follow me around everywhere I went. Some states were starting to cross-reference birth and death records, probably in an effort to prevent illegal aliens and others from using a birth certificate of a deceased person. When they received a request for a birth certificate, they would first check to make certain no death certificate was on file for that person. If there was, they would stamp deceased in big, bold letters on the copy of the certified birth certificate that they sent out. So I needed to find deceased infants that met all my other criteria and had been born in a different state. In addition, being super cautious about this, I had my eye on the future, anticipating that surrounding states might at some point start reporting deaths to each other if the deceased was born in a neighboring state. This could be a major problem if, for example, I applied for a passport in the future under my new identity. When verifying a passport application, the Department of State checks the validity of the applicant's birth certificate and could uncover the fraud if a cross-referencing program were developed in the future. Because I had to avoid such risks, I would only use identities of infants who were born several states away. I spent an entire week searching with the microfiche. When I found a potential candidate, I would hit the copy button and a printer would come to life and churn out a copy of the death certificate. Why did I bother getting as many as I could find? Just for backup, in case I ever found myself needing to change my identity again. Everyone else in the office was just as warm and friendly as the registrar. One day a clerk came up to me and said, "I have a relative in Las Vegas I've lost track of. You're a private investigator, so I wondered if maybe you could help me find him." She gave me as many details as she had. That night, in my hotel room, I ran a people search using an information broker database service to find her relative's address, and then called line assignment at the local phone company to obtain the unlisted phone number. No big deal. I felt good about helping this lady because everybody had been so kind and helpful to me. I felt I was just repaying them for the favor. When I handed her the information the following morning, she was so ecstatic that she rewarded me with a big hug, making far more of a fuss over me than I felt I deserved for so little effort. From that moment on, her fellow clerks became even friendlier, inviting me to share their donuts and telling me anecdotes about their lives. Each day as I worked, the nearby printers would be drumming away, printing out certificates that people had requested. The din was annoying. On my third day, getting up to stretch my legs after several hours of sitting, I walked by the printers to take a closer look, and I noticed a pile of boxes sitting by them. When I saw what was in the boxes, my jaw dropped. Hundreds of blank birth certificates. I felt as if I had just stumbled on a pirate's treasure chest as I watched the certificates roll out of the printer. And yet another treasure. The device for embossing the certificates with the official state seal of South Dakota was kept outside the microfiche room, sitting on a long wooden table. Each clerk would just walk up to the table and emboss a certificate before sending it out. The next morning, the weather turned bitter, with snow flurries and freezing temperatures. Luckily, I had thought to bring along a heavy jacket that I put on before going to the state registrar. I worked through the morning, waiting for the lunch hour. When most of the staff was either out of the office or busy eating and chatting, I draped the jacket over my arm and strolled to the restroom, nonchalantly scoping out where all of the remaining employees were and how distracted or attentive they seemed to be. On my way back to the microfiche room, I walked by the table where the embosser was kept. In a single smooth gesture, without slowing down, I grabbed it, holding it so it was hidden under my jacket, and continued back to the fiche room. Once inside, I glanced out the door. No one was paying any attention. With the embosser now resting on a table next to a stack of blank birth certificates, I began to emboss the state seal onto them, trying to work quickly but quietly. I was struggling to hold my fear in check. If anyone were to walk in and see what I was doing, I knew I would probably be arrested and carted away. Within about 5 minutes, I had a stack of some 50 embossed blank certificates. I headed back to the restroom, on the way returning the embosser to the exact position it had been in before I borrowed it. Mission accomplished. I had gotten away with a dangerous task. At the end of the day, I stuck the embossed certificates into my notebook and walked out the door. By the close of the work week, I had the information I needed for numerous identities. Later, I would only need to write the Bureau of Vital Statistics in the state where the child was born and request a certified copy of the deceased's birth certificate. With it, I would become the new me. I also had 50 blank birth certificates, each neatly embossed with the South Dakota state seal. Several years later, when the feds were returning property that had been seized from me, they accidentally gave back the embossed South Dakota birth certificates as well. Alex Kasparovicius, who was picking the stuff up for me, thoughtfully pointed out that they probably didn't really want to do that. The state registrar employees were sorry to see me go. I had made such a good impression that a couple of the ladies even hugged me as I said goodbye. That weekend, I drove back to Sioux Falls and treated myself to my very first skiing lesson. It was glorious. I can still hear the instructor shouting at me, "Snowplow! Snowplow!" I enjoyed the sport so much that I soon took it up as one of my regular weekend activities. There aren't many big cities in the United States like Denver, with ski slopes within such easy driving distance. Not many parents get Social Security cards for their infants, but it's suspicious for a guy in his 20s to walk into a Social Security office, ask to be issued a card, and say that he has never had one before. So I had my fingers crossed that some of the names I had dug out of the South Dakota files were for deceased tykes whose parents had obtained Social Security numbers for them. As soon as I was back in my new apartment in Denver, I called my buddy Ann at the Social Security Administration and had her check a few of the names with their associated dates of birth to see if a social had already been issued. The third name, Brian Merrill, was a hit. Baby Brian had had a Social Security number. Fantastic. I had found my permanent identity. There was one more thing I needed to do. I had uncovered a lot of information about the FBI's operation, yet the key to unlocking the central puzzle had eluded me. Who was the guy I knew as Eric Hines? What was his real name? I'm not even vaguely in his category, but just as Sherlock Holmes's work was about solving puzzles as much as it was about catching criminals and miscreants, my hacking, too, was always concerned in some way with unraveling mysteries and meeting challenges. Finally, I thought of an avenue I had never explored. Eric had encyclopedic knowledge about the Polson case. He claimed to have accompanied Kevin Polson on several Pac Bell break-ins and boasted that the two of them had found SAS together. Hours and hours online, scouring databases like Westlaw and LexisNexis for newspaper and magazine articles that made any mention of Eric, had yielded nothing. If he had really done the things with Polson that he said he had, maybe I could work backward by searching for the names of Polson's other known cohorts. Eureka. In no time at all, I found an article on LexisNexis that named two Polson co-defendants, Robert Gilligan and Mark Lottor. Maybe one of these guys was the phony Eric Hines. I got on the phone immediately, hiding my excitement as I called the law enforcement telephone number at the California DMV and ran both co-defendants' driver's licenses. Dead end. One guy was too short to be Eric, the other too heavy. I kept at it. And then, one day, on Westlaw, I found an article that had just been published. A small newspaper, the Daily News of Los Angeles, had carried a story about Polson's case coming up for trial. The piece gave the names of two others charged as Polson co-conspirators, Ronald Mark Austin and Justin Tanner Peterson. I was familiar with Austin and knew what he looked like. He definitely wasn't Eric. But Peterson? Holding my hopes in check and ready to be disappointed again, I called the DMV and had the clerk read me Peterson's physical description. She said he had brown hair and brown eyes, was 6 feet tall, and weighed 145 pounds. I had always thought of Eric's hair color as being blonde, but otherwise the description fit him to a T. I had finally cracked his cover. I now knew the real name of the man who called himself Eric Hines. He wasn't a fed. He was just a snitch, trying to trap me and probably as many other hackers as he could to save his own ass. After all of that work, all of my thinking and worrying about who and what Eric was, I was smiling from ear to ear. I was elated. The FBI was so proud of its global reputation, but hadn't been able to protect a snitch from being unmasked by one lone hacker. With my South Dakota research and my weekend of skiing behind me, it was time for my first day of work at the law firm. I was shown to a desk in an office inside the computer room, adjacent to the desks of two other members of the department's staff, Liz and Darren. Both made me feel welcome, which I was coming to find was typical of Denver, where the people seemed laid back, open, and friendly. Ginger, although a co-worker, had an office on the other side of the computer room. She, too, was very friendly. I was starting to get comfortable with my new life, while at the same time never forgetting that at any moment I might be forced to run to avoid being locked up again in the tiny coffin of a cell in solitary. Still, working at a law firm came with some unexpected benefits. The firm occupied 5 floors near the top in the posh 50-story skyscraper known as the Cash Register Building because the top of the building was curved, like a cash register. After hours, I'd log on to the Westlaw account and read law books and in the law library, researching how to get out of the scrape I had gotten myself into. 27. Here comes the sun. My main duties in the information technology department at the law firm fell into the computer operations category, solving problems with printers and computer files, converting files from Word Perfect to Word and several other formats, writing scripts to automate procedures, and doing system and network administration tasks. I was also given a couple of major projects, connecting the firm to the Internet. This was just when the Internet was beginning to be much more widely used, and installing and managing a product called SecureID, which provides two-form factor authentication. Authorized users have to provide the 6-digit code displayed on the SecureID device in conjunction with a secret PIN for remote access to the firm's computer systems. One of my collateral duties, and I couldn't have designed this better if I'd been handing out job assignments myself, was a shared responsibility for supporting the firm's telephone billing management system. That meant studying the telephone accounting application, on company time, no less. This was how I learned exactly where to add some programming instructions that would turn the application into an early warning system for me. I wrote a script that would check every outgoing phone call from the law firm against a hit list of area codes and telephone prefixes, and my list of numbers included, guess what? Right, the FBI and U.S. Attorney's offices in Los Angeles and Denver. If a call was made to any number within those agencies, the script I wrote would send a message to my pager with the code 6565. Easy for me to remember because it was the last 4 digits of the main number assigned to the Los Angeles FBI office. While I was at the firm, I actually got that code twice, and it scared the crap out of me both times. On each occasion, I waited a few minutes with a knot in my stomach, then looked up the number that had been called and dialed it myself. Both times, the call had been placed to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, but to the civil division, not the criminal division. Whew. In my spare time, I was still working out at the YMCA every day, of course, and still keeping busy with my hacking projects, of course. But I was also finding time to enjoy the variety of activities that Denver had to offer. The planetarium, besides reawakening a childhood interest in astronomy, also offered laser light shows accompanied by rock music, often from favorite bands of mine like Pink Floyd, Journey, and The Doors, a really enjoyable experience. I was starting to settle into my new cover identity, becoming more sociable. Sometimes I'd go to one of the local dance clubs, just to find people to talk to. I met a girl I dated a few times, but I didn't think it would be fair to her for us to get more involved. If I got picked up by the feds, anyone I was close to could be put in a very uncomfortable situation, either being leaned on to give evidence against me, or maybe even becoming a suspect herself. And, too, there was always a chance that I'd say something to give myself away, or she might spot some documents identifying me by some other name, or overhear a phone call. Pillow talk can have its dangers. From comments by fellow prisoners while I was in custody, I had learned that most had been ratted out by their significant others. I wasn't going to make the same mistake. There was a bookstore in the Cherry Creek area of Denver called The Tattered Cover, where I'd drink my fill of coffee and read computer books one after another. I tried a few of the rock clubs, but they drew a heavy metal crowd of brawny guys with tats, so I felt more than a little out of place. Sometimes I'd just go bike riding and enjoy the scenery, the glorious Denver scenery, with all those mountains, so beautifully snow-capped in winter, or visit a casino on one of the nearby Indian reservations to play a little blackjack. I always looked forward to my next conversation with my mom, using those prearranged signals where she'd call from one of the casinos. Sometimes Graham would be with her. Those calls were so important to me, making me feel happy inside and giving me strength, though they were a great inconvenience to my family and a huge risk for me, should the feds decide to step up their surveillance. It was hard not being closer to my mom and grandmother, who had showered me with so much love, caring, and support. Meanwhile, to change my appearance, and maybe also as a natural part of approaching the age of 30, I let my hair grow long, so it eventually reached shoulder length. I liked a lot of things about my new life. After several months in Denver, I was ready for a trip to see my family, traveling this time by Amtrak. Mom and Graham came to the train station to pick me up. Now that my hair was long and my mustache had sprouted, my own mother almost didn't recognize me. It was a really cool reunion, and I entertained them with stories about my job and my coworkers at the law firm. I was able to feel more relaxed in Vegas now, thanks to my credentials as Eric Weiss, but I was still cautious. My mom and I would meet in unlikely locations. I'd get into her car in a parking garage and lie down in the back seat until she had driven into her own garage at home and closed the door. She fussed over me and made foods I liked, pressing seconds on me, even as she told me how pleased she was that I still looked trim and fit. I could see how much strain this whole thing had put on Graham, but even more so on my mom. Though she was happy and comforted to see me, having me there in person seemed to make her that much more aware of how much she missed me and how worried she was about my safety in Denver. And I constantly felt her conflict between cherishing my visit and fearing that my being in her company put me in much graver danger. In the week I was there, we probably got together a dozen times. Back in Denver, the atmosphere at work soon slid downhill after my boss, the easygoing Lori, left the firm to join her husband in running their own business, Rocky Mountain Snowboards. Her replacement, a thin brunette named Elaine Hill, was not as friendly. Though quite smart, she struck me as calculating and was a schoolteacher type, not a people person like Lori. My co-workers in IT were so different from one another that they seemed almost like the characters in a play. Ginger, who had big teeth and was a bit on the pudgy side, was 31 and married. She took something of a liking to me, and we enjoyed a little playful banter at times. Still, I don't think I did anything to suggest I had any sort of sexual interest in her, and certainly nothing to justify a couple of remarks she made to me around the office. She commented late one evening when we were both in the computer room, "I wonder what would happen if you had me laid out on this table and somebody walked in." Huh? Or maybe those come-ons of hers were actually intended to disarm me so I wouldn't become suspicious of her. Back in L.A., before I went on the run, one of the people in my social circle with Lewis had been a guy named Joe McGuckin, a doughy guy with a round face and a sizable belly, bespectacled, close-shaven, but still looking like he had a day's growth, his brown hair hanging partway down his forehead in girly bangs. The three of us used to hang out together, so often eating at Sizzler and then going to a movie afterward that Lewis and I nicknamed him Sizzler in a Movie. In a conversation we had while I was living in Denver, Lewis told me that Joe had given him an account on a Sun workstation he had at home. Lewis passed the credentials along to me with a request. He was hoping I could get root on Joe's workstation and then tell him how I got in so he could needle Joe about it. That sounded to me like an interesting opportunity. Since Joe was a contractor for Sun Microsystems, he very likely had the ability to remotely access the company's network, which might be a way for me to hack into Sun. Whenever we had discussed hacking back in those days in L.A., Joe had always insisted that his workstation was as secure as Fort Knox. I thought, oh, I'm going to have fun messing with him. Our love of pulling pranks was a common trait that had drawn Lewis and me together ever since our pranks with the drive-up windows at McDonald's. I called Joe's home phone number first to make sure he wasn't there, then dialed the modem line at his house. Once I had logged in using Lewis's account, it took me only a few minutes to discover that Joe hadn't kept his security patches up to date. So much for Fort Knox. By exploiting a flaw in a program called RDIST, I popped root on his system. Let the games begin. When I listed the processes he was running, I was surprised to see Crack, the popular program for cracking passwords, written by a guy named Alec Muffet. Why would Joe be running that? It didn't take long to find the password file that Crack was working on. I stared at the screen, stunned by what I was seeing. Joe McGuckin, Sun Microsystems contractor, was cracking the passwords of the company's engineering group. I couldn't fucking believe this. It was as if I had just taken a walk in the park and found a bag of $100 bills. After I copied off the cracked passwords, my next hunt was through Joe's emails, searching on the keywords modem and dial-up. Bingo. I found an internal Sun email containing the information I was hoping for. It read, in part, "From Kessler at Sparky, Tom Kessler, to ppp-announce@com. Subject, new PPP server. Our new PPP server, Mercury, is now up and running, available for you to test your connection. The phone number for Mercury is 415-691-9311. I also copied the original Sun password files, which contained the encrypted password hashes, that Joe was in the process of cracking in case I lost access to his machine. Included in the cracked password list was Joe's own son password, which, as I recall, was something like Party 5. Crack had broken that one, too. A walk in the park. That night, I periodically logged in to see if Joe was online and active. Even if he noticed that there had been an incoming call on his modem, it might not arouse his suspicion. I hoped, because he would remember giving Lewis access. Sometime after midnight, Joe's computer went quiet. I figured he had nodded off for the night. Using the point-to-point protocol, I logged into Sun's Mercury host, posing as Joe's workstation, named Oileen. Voila! My computer was now an official host on Sun's worldwide network. Within a couple of minutes, with the help of Ardist, I had managed to get root, since Sun, like Joe, had been lax about updating the security patches. I set up a shell account and installed a simple backdoor giving me future root access. From there, I targeted the engineering group. This was totally familiar stuff, but at the same time totally exhilarating. I was able to log into most of the Sun machines in engineering, thanks to Joe's efforts in cracking that group's passwords. So Joe had, without even knowing it, set me up to grab yet another treasure. The latest and greatest version of the Sun OS, a flavor of the Unix operating system developed by Sun Microsystems for its server and workstation systems. It wasn't hard to find the master machine storing the Sun OS source code. Even when compressed, though, this was one humongous package of data. Not as massive as DEC's VMS operating system, but still massive enough to be daunting. And then I had an idea that might make the transfer easier. Targeting the Sun office in El Segundo, just south of the Los Angeles International Airport, I began by doing queries on several workstations to learn what devices were attached to them. I was looking for a user who had a tape drive connected to his computer. When I found one, I called him on the phone and said I was with the Sun Engineering Group in Mountain View. "I understand you have a tape drive connected to your workstation," I said. "One of my engineers is at a client site in L.A., and I need to transfer some files to him, but they're pretty large to transfer over a modem. Do you have a blank tape you could stick in your drive so I could write the data to that instead?" He left me hanging on the phone while he hunted down a blank tape. After a few minutes, he came back on the line and told me he was shoving it in the drive. I had encrypted the compressed source code into an unintelligible blob of data, just in case he got curious and took a look. I transferred a copy to his workstation, then gave a second command to write it to the tape. When the transfer to tape was finally complete, I called him back. I asked him if he wanted me to send him a replacement tape, but as I expected, he said it was okay. I didn't need to do that. I said, "Can you put it in an envelope for me and mark it with the name Tom Warren? Are you going to be in the office for the next couple of days?" He started telling me about when he would and wouldn't be available. I interrupted him. "Hey, there's an easier way. Can you just leave it with the receptionist and I'll tell Tom to ask for it?" "Sure, he'd be glad to do that." I called my buddy Alex and asked him if he'd swing by the Sun office and pick up an envelope the receptionist was holding for Tom Warren. He was a little reluctant, knowing there was always a risk, but he overcame that a moment later and agreed with what sounded like a smile on his face. I suppose, as he remembered the kick he always got from participating in my hacking adventures. I felt triumphant. But here's the odd part. When I got the tape, I didn't even spend much time looking at the code. I had succeeded in my challenge, but the code itself was of less interest to me than the achievement. I continued acquiring passwords and software treasures from Sun, but constantly having to dial up to the modems in Mountain View was chancy. I wanted another access point into Sun's network. Time for a social engineering attack. Using my cloned cell phone, I programmed in a number with the 408 area code for Mountain View, which I would need if the system administrator in Sun's Denver sales office wanted to call me back to verify that I was who I claimed to be. Using a tool available to all Sun staffers, I pulled up a list of employees, chose Neil Hansen at random, and wrote down his name, phone number, building number, and employee number. Then I called the main number at Sun's Denver sales office and asked for the computer support person. "Hi, this is Neil Hansen with Sun in Mountain View. Who's this?" I asked. "Scott Lyons. I'm the support person in the Denver office." "Cool. Later today, I'm flying to Denver for some meetings. I was wondering if you guys had a local dial-up number so I can access my email without having to make long-distance calls back to Mountain View.
Sure, we have a dial-up, but I have to program it to dial you back. The system does that for security reasons, he told me.
No problem, I said. The Brown Palace Hotel has direct dial numbers for the guest rooms. When I get into Denver later this evening, I can give you the number.
What's your name again? He asked, sounding a little suspicious.
Neil Hansen.
What's your employee number? He demanded.
10322. He put me on hold for a moment, presumably to check me out. I knew he was using the same tool I'd used to look up Hansen's information.
Sorry, Neil, I just had to verify you in the employee database. Give me a call when you get in, and I'll set that up for you.
I waited until just before quitting time, called Scott back, and gave him a local 303 Denver number that I had cloned to my cell phone. When I started a connection, a callback would come to the cell phone. I'd manually answer it, and then my modem would make a connection. For several days, I used this access point to get into Sun's internal network. But then, abruptly, the callbacks stopped working. Damn, what had happened? I dialed back into Mountain View and accessed the system in Denver.
Oh, shit. Scott had fired off an urgent email to Brad Powell with Sun's security department. He had turned on the logging feature on the dial-up I was using and captured all my session traffic. He quickly realized that I was not checking my mail at all, but poking around in places I shouldn't be. I deleted the log file so there wouldn't be any evidence of my visits and immediately stopped using the cell phone number I had given him.
Did this discourage me from hacking into Sun? Of course not. I just went back to using Sun's Mountain View dial-up to find more connections into SWAN, Sun's wide area network, in case I got locked out of the system. I wanted to establish multiple access points so I'd always have a variety of ways of getting in. I targeted all of Sun's sales offices in the United States and Canada, each of which had its own local dial-up so its staff could access SWAN without needing to make long-distance calls to the company's Mountain View headquarters. Compromising these offices was a piece of cake. While exploring Sun's network, I stumbled across a server with the host name Elmer, which stored the entire database of bugs for all of Sun's operating systems. Each entry included everything from the initial report or detection of a bug to the name of the engineer assigned to tackle the issue to the specific new code implemented to fix the problem. A typical bug report read, Synopsis, syslog can be used to overwrite any system file. Keywords, security, password, syslog, overwrite, system. Severity, 1. Priority, 1. Responsible manager, KWD. Description. Syslog and syslogd feature of log_user can be used to overwrite any system file. The obvious security violation is using syslog to overwrite /etc/password. This can be done to remote systems if loghost is not set to localhost. B. Powell. Break-in code removed for security reason. If you need a copy of the break-in code, see Stacy Way, contractor. StacyW@Castello.corp. Workaround. None, except turning off syslog, which is unacceptable. Interest list. Brad.Powell@corp. Dan.Farmer@corp. Mark.Graf@corp. Comments. This one is pretty serious. It has already been used on Sunbar to break root and is one of the few security bugs that work for 4.1.x as well as 2.x, e.g. any Sun-released OS. To use one of my favorite expressions, this again was like finding the Holy Grail. I now had access to every bug discovered internally at Sun as well as every one reported by any other source. It was like putting a quarter into a slot machine and winning the progressive jackpot with the first pull of the handle. The information from this database was going into my bag of tricks. I started thinking of the tune to the old Felix the Cat theme song. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks. After the Sun system administrator in Denver reported the security incident, the company got wise that it had a gremlin deeply burrowed into its systems. Dan Farmer and Brad Powell, Sun's top two security people, sent emails around the entire company
warning staff to watch out for hacker attacks that also used social engineering. Then they began removing the bug reports from the database in hopes of hiding them from me. But I was still reading their internal emails. Many of the bug reports contained statements like the one in the message above. Did you notice it? If you need a copy of the break-in code, see Stacy Way, contractor, Stacy W at Castello.corp. You probably already know what I'd do when I saw a message like this. Right. I'd email Stacy from an internal Sun account and social engineer her into sending me the bug. It never failed. Not once. Despite my success in hacking into the company, the following year Powell would receive a merit award from Sun's chief information officer for his role in securing Sun and thwarting the attacks on Swan by Kevin Mitnick. Powell was so proud of the award that he listed it on his resume, which I discovered on the internet. After about 6 months of morning and evening bus commutes, it seemed like a good idea to move nearer to work. The ideal location would be someplace I could walk to work from every morning, plus the right place would put me within walking distance of the 16th Street Mall in downtown Denver, my favorite area to hang out on weekends. An old-style apartment building, the Grosvenor Arms on East 16th Street, had a unit available on the fifth floor that I was excited to find. A very cool place, spacious, with windows all around, and even old-style boxes where the milkman used to leave bottles of milk every morning. This time I would have to undergo a credit check, but no sweat. By hacking into the credit reporting agency TRW, I was able to identify several Eric Weisses with reasonably good credit. I used the social security number of one of them on my rental application, different from the one I was using for employment. My paperwork sailed through without a problem. Only about five blocks from my new apartment, Denver's tourist district offered tons of terrific bars and restaurants. One in particular was a favorite, a Mexican restaurant at 16th and Larimer Streets that was a hangout for lots of great-looking girls. I was still avoiding serious relationships, but chatting up attractive young ladies at the bar didn't cross any of my barriers of caution, and it helped me feel human. On occasion, a gal would sit down next to me and let me buy her a drink or two, or sometimes even buy them for me. Great for the ego. Having so many restaurants nearby held particular appeal. I ate out almost every meal, rarely fixing even oatmeal or bacon and eggs for myself. Settling into the new apartment made me feel even more comfortable about being in Denver, yet I knew I could never let my guard down. With full access into Pactel Cellular, I was still keeping track of the cell phone calls that the FBI agents were making to Justin Peterson, a.k.a. Eric Hines, and also watching to see if they were making any calls to Denver phone numbers. A check of Justin's landline at the safe house showed that his long-distance service, MCI, was still in the name of Joseph Wernley, which meant it was probably still being paid for by the Bureau. Justin's snitching hadn't helped the feds catch me, but they obviously still had him in harness. I wondered what hackers he was targeting and trying to put into prison now that I was out of his reach. One day while working in the computer room with Darren and Liz, I noticed that Darren had turned his computer at an angle that would make it difficult for anyone else to see what he was doing, which naturally made me suspicious. I fired up a program called Watch. Aptly named, it let me watch everything on his screen. I couldn't believe my eyes. He was in the law firm's human resources directory and had pulled up the payroll file, displaying the pay and bonuses of all the lawyers, assistants, support staff, receptionists, and IT workers, as well as every other employee of the firm, from the highest-earning partner to the lowest-paid clerk. He scrolled down to a listing that read, Weiss, Eric, Comp, Oper, MIS, $28,000, $429.93. The nerve of this guy, looking up my salary. But I could hardly complain. I knew he was spying on me only because I was spying on him. 28. Trophy Hunter. I'd fallen into a comfortable routine as a new citizen of Denver. During the day, I'd go into work at the law firm on a regular shift from about 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Afterward, I'd go to the gym for a few hours, grab dinner at a local restaurant, then head home or back to the law firm and spend until bedtime doing you know what. hacking was my entertainment. You could almost say it was a way of escaping to an alternate reality, like playing a video game. But to play my game of choice, you had to stay alert at all times. One lapse in attention or sloppy mistake, and the feds could show up at your door. Not the simulated G-men, not the black wizards of Dungeons and Dragons, but the real, honest-to-God, lock-you-up-and-throw-away-the-key feds. At the time, I was busy finding systems to explore and ways to match wits with the security experts, network and system administrators, and clever programmers I encountered in my alternate reality. I was doing it purely for the thrill. Since I couldn't really share my exploits with anyone, I set my sights on obtaining the source code for things that interested me, such as operating systems and cellular phones. If I could get the code, it would be my trophy. I was becoming so good at it that sometimes it seemed too easy. Now that I had put everything on the line by cutting ties with my former life, I had nothing to lose. I was primed and ready. How could I raise the stakes? What could I do that would make every hack that came before it seem like child's play? The world's leading tech companies supposedly had the best security in the world. If I really wanted trophies that meant something, I was going to have to try to hack into them and get their code. I had already had good success with Sun. Now I targeted Novell, which I discovered used a server running the Sun OS operating system as its firewall gateway. I exploited a bug in a program called Sendmail, which was used, among other things, to receive email from the outside world. My goal was to get the source code for one of the leading network operating systems in the world, Novell's NetWare. I was able to create any file with any content I wanted by exploiting an unpatched security flaw in the Sendmail program. I would connect over the network to the Sendmail program and type in a few commands like these. Mail from bin. Receipt to /bin/.rhosts. Text omitted. .mailfrom/bin. Receipt to /bin/.rhosts. Data. +++.quit. These commands caused the Sendmail program to create a .rhosts file, which makes it possible to log in without a password. For the technical listener, I was able to create a .rhosts file in the bin account configured to allow me to log in without having to provide a password. A .rhosts file is a configuration file used with certain legacy system programs known as the rservices, which are used for logging in or executing commands on a remote computer. For example, a .rhosts file can be configured to allow the user Kevin from the host name Condor to log in without providing a password. In the example above, two plus signs separated by a space provides a wildcard for both the user and the host name of the computer, meaning that any user can log into the account or execute commands. Because the bin account had write access to the /etc directory, I was able to replace the password file with my own modified version that allowed me to gain root access. Next, I installed a hacked version of TelnetD that would capture and store the password of anyone who logged into the Novell gateway machine. As I was getting myself established on Novell's network, I saw that two other users were logged in and active. If they happened to notice that somebody else was logged in from a remote location, they would immediately know that the company was being hacked. So I took steps that made me invisible. If any system administrator called up a list of everyone who was on the system at that time, I wouldn't show up. I continued watching until one of the administrators logged into the gateway. I was then able to capture his password for the root account. The password was #4kids=$$. Cute. It didn't take me long to get into another system called Ithaca, which was one of the engineering group's systems in Sandy, Utah. Once I compromised that system, I was able to retrieve the encrypted password file for the entire engineering group and recover the passwords of a large number of users. I searched the system administrator's email for the keywords modem, dial-up, and dial-in in various forms, singular, plural, with and without a hyphen following dial, and so on, which led me to messages answering employee questions, such as, what number do I use to dial in? Very handy. Once I found a dial-up, I started using that as my access point rather than going in through Novell's internet gateway. For starters, I wanted to find the system that contained the source code for the NetWare operating system. I started searching through the email archives of the developers, looking for certain words that might lead me to the process used to commit updates to the source code repository. I eventually found the hostname of the source code repository, ATM. It wasn't a cash machine, but to me it was worth much more than money. I then went searching back through emails looking for ATM and found the names of a few employees who supported the system. I spent hours trying to log into ATM using the Unix-based credentials I had intercepted, but without success. Finally, I was able to find a valid account, but it didn't have rights to access the source code repositories. Time for my standard fallback, social engineering. I called the number for a lady who worked in support on ATM. Using the name of an engineer whose password I had cracked, I told her I was working on a project and needed access to the NetWare 3.12 client source code. My gut told me something just wasn't right, but the lady didn't sound at all hesitant. When she came back on the line and told me she had given me the rights I'd requested, I felt a familiar surge of adrenaline. But after only 15 minutes, my session was disconnected, and I couldn't reconnect. I was locked out. Moments later, the engineer changed his password. Uh-oh, that didn't take long to figure out. Later, I learned that the lady had had previous conversations with the engineer, whose name I used, and realized my voice didn't sound like his. She knew I was an imposter. Damn. Well, win some, lose some. I called another administrator who also supported ATM and convinced him to add access rights to one of the other accounts I had compromised, only to be locked out again. I also placed backdoors in numerous systems to capture credentials as users logged in. By now, I had been working on this project for several days. Searching emails was a quick means of discovering where I could find the tasty data, the information that would lead to additional ways into the network, or to software bugs, or to source code that interested me. Now that I knew they would be watching closely and weren't likely to fall for the same trick again, I changed my tactics. What if I targeted a developer who had full access and tricked him into copying everything for me? I wouldn't even need to find a way into ATM to get what I wanted. After exploring Novell's internal network for several days, I found a cool tool accessible to any Novell employee. The program, called 411, listed the name, phone number, login name, and department of each staffer. My luck was starting to change. I dumped out the entire employee list to a file for analysis. As I looked through the list, it became clear that all the developers worked in a group called ENGSFT. I figured the NetWare development was likely handled out of Provo, Utah, the company headquarters. Looking through the directory using these two criteria, I randomly chose a listing. Nevarez, Art, 801-429-3172. A. Nevarez, ENGSFT. Now that I had my mark, I needed to pose as a legitimate Novell employee. I wanted to choose a contractor or someone else who was unlikely to be known by my target. The phone directory also contained a department named Univell that had probably been formed when Novell and AT&T's Unix System Laboratories started up a joint venture in 1991. I needed to find an employee who wasn't going to be in the office. My first choice was Nault, Gabe, 801-568-8726, Gabe, Univell. I called and got his voicemail greeting, which very conveniently announced that he would be out of the office for the next few days without access to email or voicemail. From the employee directory file, I picked out a lady who worked in the telecommunications department and dialed her number. "Hi, Karen," I said. "This is Gabe Nault calling from Midvale. Last night I changed my voicemail password, but it doesn't work. Can you please reset it?" "Sure, Gabe. What's your number?" I gave her Gabe's number. "Okay, your new password is the last 5 digits of your telephone number." I thanked her politely, immediately dialed Gabe's phone, keyed in the digits for the new password, and recorded the outgoing greeting in my own voice, adding, "I have several meetings today, so it's best to leave a voicemail. Thank you." Now I was a legitimate Novell employee with an internal phone number. I phoned Art Nevarez, told him I was Gabe Nault in engineering, and asked, "Do you work with NetWare? I'm in the Univell group." "Yes," he said. "Great. Can you do me a big favor? I'm working on the NetWare for Unix project, and I need to move a copy of the NetWare 3.12 client source code to one of our boxes here in Sandy. I'll set up an account for you on the Enchilada server so you can map a drive and transfer the code.
Sure. What's your number? I'll call you after it's done, he said.
After we hung up, I was elated. No need to gain access to ATM, just leverage someone who already has it. I went to the